Be the right club. Be the right club today. Yes!
Johnny, that's better than most.
How about him?
That is better than most. Better than most!
Expect anything different?
All right, guys. Welcome back to the No Laying Up podcast. We are going to get to our interview here with Julian Suri here in a little bit. I wanted to pop in and talk about a few things going on in the world of golf before we do that. We won't have a full wrap-up podcast from Firestone, or doesn't sound like we'll have a full preview for the PGA Championship as well. But I wanted to give a shout-out to JT for his thrilling win at Firestone, the last ever WGC Bridgestone event at Firestone. Not that upset to say goodbye to Firestone, although it's been a place we've had a lot of fun memories with Big Cat. There have been some good tournaments over the years. I think a change of scenery for these events is definitely a good thing. I don't think TPC Southwind is the answer. Actually, I'm pretty positive that it's not the answer. We discuss a lot of these things on our live show on Periscope that's on Twitter. You can go back and watch the replay of that. DJ and Big Randy and I just chatted up about WGCs and everything like that. So if you're looking for that recap, go back into our Twitter feed, and that replay is available for pretty much eternity, I think. So Georgia Hall, shout out to her for winning the Ricoh Women's British Open. She is English and won in her home country of England there at Royal Lytham and St. Anne's, which was awesome to watch. She was absolutely nailed. Shot a final round 67 with kind of like a comfortable bogey on the last. She played even better than that and just played absolutely lights out to win that and win a major championship. That was awesome to watch. The Barracuda hasn't quite wrapped yet as at the time of this recording, so don't have a full update on that one. And we are pumped to roll into the last major championship. I don't know a ton about Bellerive. I've been reading up from Andy over at the Fried Egg, and he doesn't sound too thrilled or excited about it. I'm trying my best to go into this with an open mind kind of soak up the last major of the year. It does sound like this is going to be a Rees Jones special. Long and narrow course with small greens that's going to favor some bombers and the pure ball strikers. So, again, going in with an open mind, we're gonna tackle it. We're going to come in pretty strong this week with live shows and hopefully a new formatted live show on Wednesday evening, kind of previewing the event as well. So on that note, without much further ado, I want to give a shout-out to our man, hashtag Chad, at Callaway. He and his wife just welcomed a beautiful baby girl into the world. And as a special gift to them, I told him, listen, you don't even have to worry about sending me over anything today. I'm gonna do the ad all on my own and don't even worry about it. So you're welcome, Chad, for this. I could pick the topic myself, and the topic I chose is I want to talk about the X-Forged irons from Callaway. I put these in my bag back in April. I was hesitant to do it. I was playing the Apex Pros before this, and I honestly loved them. That Chad sent me a set of them. He's like, please just try them. Please try them. I put them in my bag right before we went to Bandon Dunes. I'm very happy with the decision. I'm honestly probably about a club longer with the X-Forged than I was with the Apex Pros. They're about a degree lower in loft, and I've never really been one to seek major distance with irons, but the appeal of blasting 3-iron and having about 9-iron or less in degrees has kind of transformed the way I've thought about this. The X-Forged irons are more forgiving than a blade, but they deliver plenty of feel. They're a bit offset, and they've got a really thin look from the top. And I was always worried with irons that really launch the ball how well they get in and out of the turf, but I've had no such issue with these, and they are damn sexy to look at from over top. So I imagine that helps a bit with the confidence when you're standing over one. I'm still struggling a bit to adjust to some of the distances that I'm hitting these balls, especially into the wind. I feel like I need to club up, and I end up flying greens with them. So still adjusting, but honestly couldn't be much more impressed with the X-Forged iron. So for more information on those, go to CallawayGolf.com. And let's get into our interview here with Julian Suri. For those that aren't that familiar with Julian, he is an American. He's 27 years old. He's playing on the European Tour. He has won on the European Tour. We talk a bit about his path from Duke University through the mini tour scene in Florida to the Challenge Tour towards playing the European Tour and what will hopefully be the PGA Tour next year. He is definitely a guy you want to get to know. He's going to be a guy you're probably going to see on leaderboards next year. And I imagine he's just coming to the forefront of a lot of American golf fans. So he's a fun guy to root for. He's a bit of a trash talker, so I'm not gonna pump him up any more than that. You'll hear a bit of that as we go on. Me and Randy got a chance to play with him last week at Tim Aquana, and we sat down with him in the clubhouse for a podcast interview afterwards. So without further ado, enjoy that, and hopefully we'll be in touch with you guys later this week during the PGA Championship. All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the No Laying Up podcast here at Tim Aquana Country Club, home turf here with noted sandbagger Julian Suri. Let's just start it off. I want you to explain to the listeners the entire situation we had at Sawgrass Country Club last week, and then I'll tell the real version after that. But
you know, I'm usually not used to playing with inferior players, so when everyone else on tour is better than you,
is that what you're saying?
Well, you know, substantially inferior. So when I'm presented with the task of stroking somebody that I've never seen, but two, also a past PGA professional, it's a little bit challenging. And I assumed we were on the same deal from the front to back nine, and then I get labeled as a sandbag. I feel like this has all been kind of, you know, retroactively labeled, and I
retroactive.
Feel a little bit victimized.
It's funny that you use that word. You were deciding after the holes were over if we got strokes on that hole, and you were only giving four strokes. You were playing as a plus three, and you are the 62nd ranked player in the world. I've
just taken 3 days off after 5 weeks on the road. I am the victim here. I've been.
You won the money. We went out today and got you out here at Tim Aquana on the home turf, and I got the proper amount of strokes, and it still didn't matter for the record. Right. But
we hit the quan properly today.
Hit the quan. But all right, Larry, we're gonna start this off. We want to kind of get into your background. Let's just assume that anyone listening to this is not familiar with you at all. So walk us through your background, why you're in Jacksonville, and why you're American playing the European Tour.
I'd probably say different than most. I was born in New York City. I lived in just outside New York City until I was 10. My parents worked in Manhattan, like I said, until I was 10. And then we moved down to Jacksonville. My dad got a new job partly, but also because I had shown pretty good potential in golf, and you know, Florida was kind of where you needed to be. So I've lived in the area just south of Jacksonville in St. Augustine since I was 10 years old, and kind of progressed. And then ended up going to Duke, finished that up in 2013, and was kind of struggling there for a couple years. Started to lose my swing at the end of my senior year at Duke, and I'd never had a swing coach my whole life. I'd never had any sort of formal instruction, and I'd done all right with some somewhat good results at college, and I was an All-American once, but. When the good was good, it was really good. But when the bad was bad, it really hit the fan. So, I was pretty stubborn to kind of see somebody. And so, at the end of 2015, I thought, my game was good enough to do the Q school. So I did the European Q school. My rationale for that was, you make it to final stage of Q school.
Well, first, before we do that, because I've tried to do a little notes preparing for this and whatnot, okay. I couldn't find like record of, you said you turned pro in 2013. I couldn't find what you were doing in that 2 year span. So walk us through what was happening during that few year span you turned pro.
So I turned pro in the fall of 2013, did the web.com Q school, missed out on that, did the Asian Tour Q school in January of 2014 in Thailand, missed out on that. So I come back. I'm just playing mini tours. I'm playing what was then the Swing Thought. They've had a million different sponsors, the Hooters. It was the whole old Hooters tour, NGA it was. Was playing pretty crappy, honestly, and was just kind of, I was pretty stubborn to find help. And 14 was probably the worst year because there was no, I'd play golf at my home course and I'd lose 5-6 golf balls around, and it was just it wasn't fun. And I don't know why it took me so long to find somebody who would help. It takes me a while to kind of trust people too, and that's a pretty personal part of who I am is my golf swing. So it took some time. I was playing a lot of Moonlight Tour. Those were like 1 day events in Orlando where you pay $100 and you show up, and the winner can get up to $500 depending on the field size. But those will get 25-30 guys. But those were just kind of reps to get going, and play West Florida Tour Monday qualifiers. It was kind of a grind. It wasn't pretty.
Did you see success with the first swing coach that you visited with, or what was that process like? Did you have to go through a number of them to find somebody that you worked well with?
No, the first swing coach I've really had was the one that I'm currently with.
Okay.
Dan Carraher. I started working with him last year at the end or at, in April of 2017. So up until then I'd seen progress, and I was just kind of like kind of throwing stuff against the wall and seeing what stuck for those, you know, 2 years or whatever.
So you kind of fought your way out of it on your own. In 2014. Okay.
To an extent. And I started to see a little bit of light at the end of the tunnel, and I was playing a little bit better. But
during that time, were you very convinced that you wanted to continue on this path? Was there ever doubt that you wanted to play professional golf at any point?
Yeah. I mean, there was always the love for the game, and that's what I always wanted to do since I was a kid, 6, 7 years old. And so it's always what I've wanted to do. But in the back of my head at times, sure, I was just like, you know, maybe I'm not cut out for this. You know, maybe I had this good junior career and solid college career, and this is my undoing. And, you know, because of my stubbornness or whatever, I'm not able to push through to the next level. And, you know, you see guys that you grew up with in junior golf and, you know, and college golf or whatever, and they're having success. And you're like, man, you know, what's the difference? And so...
Now, you know, people are looking at you probably the opposite side, wondering the same thing.
Yeah, I guess maybe. Yeah.
Well, I just find it interesting because you noted there that in April 2017 is kind of when you started working with Dan, but you turned pro, or I guess so last March, I looked this up on your official World Golf Ranking page. You played in the Barclays Kenya Open. You finished T41, and you ended the week ranked 1,142nd in the world. And 16 months later, you're ranked 62nd in the world. So something happened in that period of time where, I mean, because it's one thing to kind of come out of school and take a year to break through, but you were probably 4 years removed from school before, like almost like a post-hype sleeper breakout. So what the hell changed in that time period to make that kind of leap?
Post-hype sleeper breakout. Yeah, that's one way to put it. Yeah, it was right after I got back from Kenya. I had to take a hard look at my game because at the end of 2016, I missed my European Tour card by one. And so I played all right and for 6 rounds. And the very next week, I got my first European Tour start in Australia. Played okay. Came in 15th, I think, or 16th, something like that. And I was like, okay, maybe I'm ready to kick some ass on the Challenge Tour next year. And I started out in Kenya, and it was just like, I remember the last round, I shot one under, and I think I had 9 or 10 wedge shots, like inside 120, 130 yards, and I was inside of 30 feet once. And I shot one under. So you look at the scorecard and you're like, okay, well, it's not bad. He's not making triples and quads. But like, I was like, dude, like, come on, there's so much more in the tank. And so I went back. I was home for the entire month of April and back here in Jacksonville. And I started working with Dan like 2 days after I got back. And just worked on some changes. Pretty much had the whole month to grind on it. Went to Orlando a few times, played some moonlights, played some Florida Pro Golf Tour, which is another mini tour that's not glamorous. You got to kind of work on stuff for 3 days, 4 days, go test it out in competition, come back, get the feedback, and go from there. And it was kind of like a 4-week process. And then finally I went over to Portugal at the beginning of May last year. And that was like a co-sanctioned event between the Challenge and the European, and I came in second. And then 2 weeks later, I won a Challenge event, and it kind of propelled the rest of my summer.
So how did you, and then, yeah, later that summer, you win a European Tour event in Denmark. How did you, I think you were the first person to ever win a Challenge Tour event and a European Tour event in the same year. So how did you get into the field that week? Was it an exemption, or did you kind of get a battlefield promotion from the Challenge Tour? How'd that work?
I think it was actually the first until yesterday, or last week, until McAvoy won in Germany. But I got into Denmark just through my category. So I ended up missing the full card by one. But through the category, you still get into probably 7 or 8 European Tour events. Just it goes down the list. And there was a Challenge Tour event that week in Switzerland, which is like a no-cut event. It's called the Rolex Trophy. You get treated great. The winner gets a Rolex,
I was gonna say,
which I still don't have. I don't even wear a watch. I just look at my phone. It was kind of a debate because it's only like a 40-man field in Switzerland. And I was like, you know, which one should I play? Because, you know, obviously I want to shoot for the top, get my world ranking up as high as I can. But, or should I focus on finishing out the Challenge Tour season number one and, you know, going through that route? And finally, I was like, you know, Dion Waiters always said, you know, if you gotta bet on yourself and then double down. So I said, you know what, let's shoot for it. And so we played in Denmark, and I was home for 3 weeks before that, so I had good prep time. And yeah, game felt really good and ended up winning that week. So it was great.
And now you're kind of battling the same kind of questions, I think, between the European Tour and the PGA Tour, because you're getting spot starts really on the PGA Tour. But what is that really building towards? So what is kind of your thought process for how you choose? I mean, are you basically playing any PGA Tour event you can get in at this point? Or how do you choose your balance between the two?
Well, right now, I think this fall is going to be interesting because I have, you know, I've played all the Rolex Series events in the European Tour. And quite a few other ones. But when, like, I'm in the PGA next week, and then I'll have the web finals after that. If I get my PGA Tour card through those web finals, it's going to be kind of an interesting balancing act, because obviously I'll be a PGA Tour rookie, but I'll be in the three Race to Dubai events at the end of the year, Turkey, Ned Bank, and Dubai. And those are huge world ranking points, great fields, no cut.
Can't skip those.
It's tough to miss those, and you know, limited field events. But at the same time, you know, I want to be based in the U.S. and I'm an American, and my whole life is here. So it's just kind of going to be a kind of a balancing act a little bit.
So with reflection, you know, you said when you were kind of in the wilderness a little bit, you were wondering what the difference was. With some time to reflect, what would you say the difference was?
You know, I think a lot of people, they put a lot of emphasis on, as kids come out of college, they need to learn how to be a pro, and they need to learn how to handle themselves and be without a team or a college coach or whatever. And I think that's great for them. But I think for me, it was just a purely mechanical thing. It wasn't any, it's not like I was getting ahead of myself on the course, or I was getting frustrated or impatient. I mean, a little bit maybe, but I'd say the big majority of my problems were coming from mechanical issues. And so I just needed someone, one that I could trust, because trust is, you know, it's to trust somebody. You hear stories about all the time how swing coaches can, you know, get in the way, you know, especially like shorter players, they try to get longer and then they end up losing everything. And, you know, they start back to square one. It's a long process. So, you know, that was something I was pretty reluctant to kind of go through. But at the same time, I was pretty much at the bottom of a pretty deep well. So I kind of I had to do something, and it took me a while to kind of light the fire under my ass and do it.
And then it seems like it was a little bit incremental. I mean, it wasn't necessarily like a sudden breakthrough. It was a little bit out of a time, testing competition, come back, refine, you know, testing competition.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah,
totally incremental. I mean, it's definitely not, and that's for me, that's how I've always done it. You know, you see like a little bit of a breakthrough, and then you're like, okay, well, I did that really well, but maybe I wasn't as patient as I should have been. If I was as patient as I should have been, I probably would have won that thing running away, or you know, just little things like that. Or, you know, I needed to fix my practice swing. My practice swing wasn't the way it should have been to get me feeling the right things to go to make that change on the course on a tough tee shot or something like that. So you have these little things that you find, and then you kind of plug them back in at the next week. And so it was, yeah, very much trial and error.
Randy's a bit in the wilderness right now. He's just trying to claw. Yeah. He's trying to claw out of it. I can't tell.
I'm scratching notes over here. Yeah, appreciate it.
How do you have a count? How many countries have you been to?
Last year I went to 17. This year I haven't looked at the tally yet, but last year was 17.
How many passports have you been through?
So I went through my normal sized one last year. So in December I got a 52 pager. So I'm working on that, but I think that'll be a little while before I go through that.
I got to be honest, before I was going through your page, I didn't know that there was a Challenge Tour event in Kenya. Like, just hearing you tell the story of like, yeah, I'm in Kenya and my wedge game's not dialed in is like, God, professional golf world is insane.
Yeah,
it's so incredibly.
Nairobi's a hell of a place, man.
Nairobi is what when I was in Africa, we had a Kenyan tour guide who, I was like, what's Nairobi like? Is it nice? He goes, Nairobi? No.
Yeah, I mean, it's an experience. I was there for 10 days and we stayed in the city and got shuttled back and forth to the course and didn't see one stop sign, didn't see one traffic light.
Do intersections work?
You just go. You just kind of gun it, and whoever has the bigger pair wins out. You know, true gladiator battle. Really, it's. Yeah, we were. Are you not entertained? We were definitely entertained.
What's of all the places you've been between the Challenge Tour, European Tour, what's the place that you'd be fine not going back to?
I think once in Kenya is all right for me. I think the people are very nice and the culture is great and everything, but it's a lot. It's a lot different.
It's probably something that you enjoyed experiencing and are fine not going back to, but
Well,
you're also not looking to go back to the Challenge Tour, I don't think,
right,
as well.
Yeah,
so
that's not in the plan.
So was it an easy decision for you for this fall to go forward with the Web Finals versus staying out on the European Tour? I mean, it sounds like, I guess, what is the main appeal for playing the European Tour from your regard? I mean, I know Brooks has had success going that route, Peter Uihlein as well. Was that kind of just a bit more cultured experience, I guess, playing the European Tour than going out and trying to play the Web Tour?
Partly, but I think more of it was I saw how many, like in my case, I ended up missing my Q school card in Europe. I won. If I was in that exact same position in the web, the amount of world ranking points that I would have been exposed to are just so much more in Europe. And, I get it. I had full Challenge Tour status. I know you got a little smirk on your face. You're gonna go with your Norin conspiracy theories. The amount of Challenge Tour events, I would have had full Challenge Tour status. So all of those have 12 points, and then I would have gotten, like I said, like I did in Denmark, 7 or 8 European Tour events, which are all at least 24 points. And on the web, I think most of the events have 14 points available. But if I missed my web card, my full web status by one, I'm getting in those last minute. I can't set a schedule. I don't know. I'm doing Mondays. I'm, kind of in the,
right,
not where I want to be.
Kind of no man's land.
Just the opportunity was a little bit, I felt like the ceiling was a little bit higher to kind of crash the party. And I feel like I kind of did.
Mm-hmm. Was it a realistic goal for you this year to try to earn special temporary membership on the PGA Tour?
Yeah, it was. And I definitely didn't have the start that I wanted to. I had those three early starts at Torrey, Phoenix, and Pebble. And I had a little bit of an injury over Christmas and New Year's where I was kind of sidelined for about 3 weeks. And I only had about 5 days really to practice before Torrey. And it wasn't ideal. I was definitely a little rusty. There was that on the line. There was also just trying to get in the top 50 before the Masters, before the Players, which for me is like a fifth major having grown up here in this area. So that, all that was kind of on the line and I was pushing it. I was kind of playing a lot of events and with not a whole lot of preparation. And so I remember in March after missing the cut in India, I was like, I just need to stay home and get my game together because this isn't any fun. I'm, however many thousand miles from home and I'm shooting in over par and I don't really know what I'm doing. So, I think in the future, instead of chasing those deadlines, I need to make sure that my game is up to the task of performing.
What is kind of your rule or a guideline for when you come home? Like when you're traveling for the European Tour, if you have 1 week off, do you come home for that week or do you try to run 3 weeks in a row being home? How's that work?
If I have 1 week off, I'll stay out there. It's just a lot. I mean, you go 5-6 hours, time change. It takes, probably 2 days for me if you really try at it to get adjusted. Then it takes probably another day and a half or two once you go back. So that's 4 days that you're kind of like just laying around
in limbo, yeah.
Comatose pretty much. So then once you're that, like how much time do you actually have to practice? You lose time when you go back to Europe from here. If it's more than 1 week, then I will come back. If it's 2 weeks, I'll totally come back. And that's what I've done in the past. I've spent off weeks, and I have a buddy from college who lives in Slovenia. Spent a week there last year. Awesome. Spent a week in Dubai last year practicing. And
were you in Ljubljana?
Ljubljana. Yeah, have you been?
I've been.
Have you been to Lake Bled?
I have, yeah.
Oh, my God. One of the prettiest places
Slovenia
I've ever seen.
Is like way under the radar. Europe is unbelievable, first of all.
If you call that Eastern Europe to him, he'll slap you in the face. He says Central Europe because it's closer to Italy.
Yeah,
so he calls that central, south central.
I guess they do share a border there, I guess, a little bit with Italy. But that place, like all those countries, all the old Yugoslav countries are just incredible to
visit.
Awesome,
so much history. I mean, the downtown Ljubljana, like a little river that kind of goes through it and all the buildings. There's castles that light up at night. It's a pretty, pretty cool place. We've had some fun nights there.
I don't want to say Eastern Europe again, but everyone that always asks for advice on where to go in Europe, I'm like, Paris, Rome, that's cool, but go to like Prague, go to Budapest, go to Croatia. Like that's where where the real fun, I think, is. So that's what I was always wondering. If you take a week off in Europe, do you just go around touring a little bit, or do you practice most of the time? Or the tour's not in Europe that much anyways, but how do you spend your time on the off weeks? I've always curious
about that. Yeah, I mean, like, you know, those two off weeks definitely come to mind. Slovenia, we were, it was myself, Dylan Fratelli, and my buddy Tim Gornick, who went to Duke with me. So Dylan had just won in Austria, so we had a good time right after that. Actually, on the drive to Slovenia, he bought me like a no. We went to McDonald's. That was the first meal, and he's like, "Oh no, they don't take American Express. Julian, can you cover this?" I'm like, "Dude, are you serious?
That they take American Express in Slovenia?"
I was like, first of all, this sounds like complete bullshit, but second of all, it's okay. I'll take care of it." And then so that we went out a couple nights, and then we were practicing, we were grinding for the most part, and we'd sightsee a little bit. They did a swim from the shores of Lake Bled to that little castle in the middle of the lake, which I'm not
that's
a strong swimmer.
Not an easy swim.
I'm not a strong swimmer, so I just kind of laid by the I just did my thing, evened out my tan lines. But it was fun. I mean, went to the gym, you know, did normal stuff I'd do at home. Dubai, definitely a lot of sightseeing because there's so much to see. I was there in October, so it was that place is nuts. It's so cool.
I don't know if this is the appropriate time, but I was just curious, kind of rewinding back to your high school and junior days, how it was you got to Duke and what that experience was like, playing the college game.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think Duke was, you know, probably the furthest north I was looking to go out of Jacksonville as far as schools. But the academic reputation was, you know, incredible. And once I got there on campus, like, it has a special feeling. Even now, I just watched this sort of documentary with Jay Williams called Best Shot. And he took these high school kids from New Jersey down to Duke and to a basketball game. And just seeing, like, them walking around campus and, like, them going to a basketball game and then, like, you know, eating in the student union and going to the McDonald's and everything, like, it just brings back so many memories. It's like a special place for me. And playing college golf was a great experience. You know, it was first time away from home. I think it's something that a lot of kids need, and I definitely needed that. Grow up a little bit, do my own laundry, you know, learn how to pack a suitcase by myself and stuff like that. But it was a great experience. We had a full national, we played all over the country, kind of learned how to fly, how to manage a little bit of jet lag, not quite, you know, European or all Asian jet lag, but I had a blast. I mean, a lot of my best friends come from those 4 years that I had there.
What'd you study while you were at Duke?
I majored in history, U.S. history, and got like a certificate in markets and management. So it's like in between a major and a minor.
Cool.
Is this where you showed all your European friends a Chappelle show?
Yeah, I mean, I had to enlighten them. We had Napoleon Dynamite was on the list, Chappelle show was on the list, you know, the reporter going ghetto, that was on the list. Just a lot of YouTube
you got a bit triggered today. We were here with Clint here, the pro at Tim Aquana, and you hit a putt on the putting green. He had this little red ball that's like a weighted ball that it's like to test your impact position and whatnot. You had a couple of squirrely putts with the red ball. You got out to that first green, and you were a bit triggered by the effect this had on you. Are you going to be all right for the PGA next week?
I think I'll be able to recover. You know, I think being on bent grass and knowing the feel of that will be just fine.
Red balls. Cocaine in a can, baby.
Cocaine in a can.
So going back to your win in Denmark, so you shot a final round 64 to win that day, I think. I was kind of curious as to how, going to that final round, how much of it did it feel like you had a big expectation on yourself to win, and how different did that day feel to like the French Open this past year where you had a great chance to win as well? When you think back at those 2 days, what was similar and what was different?
I think similarities between the two. I was both the times I was chasing. I was two back, I believe, in Denmark going into Sunday, and I think in France I was quite a few more back. I was like four-ish. So Denmark, I was like, I'm in the last group. I'm playing well enough to win this thing. I'm just going to give it everything I have. I'd had some putting struggles early on in Thursday and Friday. I had a bunch of three putts, like 4 or 5 3 putts in those 2 days. And I knew if I just kind of, just played my game and kept hitting it as solid as I was, it was going to fall my way. I just got to keep putting pressure on him and stay patient. I guess that's really similar to France too. France is just a freaking tough ass course, and guys are going to make mistakes. And even though I knew I was four back or whatever I was, I don't even know what I was.
I think everyone was at least three back going into the final round.
I was at 5 under going into Sunday, and I don't even know who was leading. Wood, maybe, or Kenholt?
Kenholt was winning, yeah.
He must have been 9 or 10, but I think I knew, honestly, that can be made up in two holes out there. And so guys are going to make big numbers. Again, the day before, I just had a bogey-free 2 under, I believe, and I probably could have shot 7 or 8 lower. I just didn't make a putt outside of 4 feet. So I guess it was a little bit similar in those approaches, but I also knew it was a comfortable pairing, playing with JT on Sunday there. And, you know, he's somebody that I've known for a long time since junior golf, college golf, all that. So even though people might have thought, oh, you know, the crowds were this, were that, whatever, the crowds were great. I mean, I enjoyed it. You know, I think we both birdied, I think he bogeyed 1, but we both birdied 2. We both hit it inside of 3 feet there. And from then on, I was like, you know, this is fun. You want to be with the top, I think he was number two in the world at the time. Like, this is how you want to be in this environment. And, you know, on a really difficult golf course that tests all part of your game, it was just like kind of spurred me on a little bit.
It's got to, I mean, you got to wonder, you know, you want your future, you hopefully is on the PGA Tour, and kind of it's got to be cool to see where you measure up, like, right? You're playing with one of the top players in the world and you beat him on that day.
Yeah, no, it's fun. Actually, these last 5 weeks, I had a lot of cool experiences like that. I played with the week before in Germany, I played with Tommy Fleetwood the last day, and then I played with JT there. I played with Rory in Ireland the week later, and then Scottish, I missed the cut, but the first 2 days I played with one of my childhood heroes, Ernie Els. And that was like a little bit surreal.
How great is Ernie?
I mean, he told me the real airplane stories that won't go on the air. But
we're cutting this short thing because you're gonna tell that and hear some of those.
No, but he was, just a great guy. And then at the British, you know, it was, at the Open on Sunday, I played with Lee Westwood, which is another guy I've watched since I was a kid, and so just kind of really cool experiences to play with guys. You know, the first couple weeks that are really playing really well right now in their primes, and, you know, it was great for me to compare my games. But then the last 2 weeks to play with guys that I've grown up watching, and it's just like, who always seemed a little bit, you know, surreal to me.
Yeah. You got into the Open with that runner-up finish in France. So what was it? This was your second major. You played the Open the year before. Was making the cut in a major a big deal for you? Was making it to the weekend? Was that a celebrated thing on your end?
It is when you shoot 3 over on Thursday. Yeah. it was more the way I grinded it out on Friday because, you know, I knew I needed to play well Friday to make the cut. And then, you know, especially having my dad there, and I had a couple friends from Jacksonville who also came. I didn't want them to come just watch 2 days. That sucks. Sure. So it was the way I grinded it out. I didn't make too many bogeys. I ended up birdieing 18 at Carnoustie, you know, knowing I was right there in the mix, either on the line or one in. And, you know, there's a lot of things, as we all know, that can happen on the 18th at Carnoustie. Some big numbers have been made. So, you know, I'm aware of all that, obviously. And for me to birdie, to hit it to 4 feet and make that putt was, I think, bigger than just making the cut, but it was how I performed under that
You needed to do it, yeah, kind of passing exactly. That test. What's it like to play the weekend of a major championship? How different is the buzz from what you're used to?
It's awesome. It's incredible. It's something that I kind of wish I could do like every week.
Yeah.
You know, and then especially I made a little bit of a run there Sunday. I was playing really well. I was 3 under through 16 and had an unfortunate finish with a double and a bogey. But I think I got up close to the top 10 there. And you could definitely see some people sort of accumulate, and especially on those back 9 holes. And I was still hitting good shots. And you know, that's what you want to test yourself under, those sort of conditions and those sort of that sort of environment. And it was just, as it is, I fell in love with Carnoustie last year. I played it at the Dunhill, and it was totally different conditions, but you can see how this is just a major championship venue, and it's just an overall great test. And it, you know, you finish and you're like, you're depleted, because that's, it just exhausts every part of your game. And I feel like that's what a golf course should be. Mm-hmm. And with it playing firm and fast, there's so many more variables up in the air. So for me to kind of make that run and keep executing shots the way I did, I was pretty pretty happy with where my game was at.
Because you really didn't have much any links golf experience before this past 3-4 week stretch, huh?
Yeah, that Irish Open was kind of eye-opening because I knew I was playing well from France. And you know, I mean, there's so many holes. I hit a good tee shot, gets a screwy bounce, goes in the rough, catch a flyer, go over the green, and all of a sudden I have a 12-footer for par when I feel like I didn't miss a shot. So that's how it is. You have to accept it. It's a different mindset. It's a different approach to the game, and you kind of have to just go play and accept it.
Kind of scooted past this, past the French Open, but with the Ryder Cup going to Le Golf National, what's your on the ground report from what that course is like to play and how that will play for a Ryder Cup?
I think it'll be a little different with match play. You might have guys trying to play a little bit more aggressively, but there's only a limit to how aggressive you can play that place. So, they said it's going to be a very similar setup in terms of green speeds, in terms of rough, as it was a couple weeks ago to the Ryder Cup. But you know, they're definitely angling to play for the European favor. I mean, they have the greens a little bit slower. They were running at about a 10 probably. And you know, they made it tighter for the kind of notion that the American guys like to bomb it, you know, all over the map and then find it. So yeah, I think it's going to be a great venue. The place is built for spectating. There's, you know, all in between all the holes, there's huge mounds and everything, like a little bit like Memorial or TPC Sawgrass. You know, it's built for crowds and yeah, I think it'll be a great atmosphere as long as the weather holds up.
Is there much of a buzz on the ground from fans or anything to feel like with the event coming there? Was it a topic of discussion during that week?
Yeah, totally. I mean, you know, I think that was a major part. I mean, it definitely added to the intrigue of me wanting to play that because, you know, it's a long stretch leading up to the Open, and obviously I wasn't in the Open yet, but 4 or 5 events in a row is a lot, and a lot of guys would skip either one of them or, you know, some sort of combination of them to prep for the Open. And, you know, I kind of put that on my list as like one I can't miss because it is a Ryder Cup course. It's going to get a great feel. This is where I want to test my game. I know it's a tough course. It rewards really solid ball striking. And this is where I want to be. So
after that 5 week stretch, you're home here for 2 weeks. Is 2 weeks in a row off? Is that too long for you? Do you start itching to get back out there, or did you need that kind of decompression time after that stretch?
No, I definitely needed some time. 5 weeks is a lot, and you know, I played pretty well, but I'd also had stuff I needed to work on, and so you know, I could take 2-3 days off and kind of rest a little bit, but then I'm ready to get back to, you know, by the time Friday of last week hit. Or Thursday or Friday, I was ready to get back to work. And then now it's, you know, I'm a couple days away from leaving for the PGA and I'm ready to go compete. And, you know, I kind of undervalue how much rest is how important that is. I think before last year, but, you definitely need to mentally recharge your batteries and be ready to go, especially for a major, because you can't be, pissing shots away.
I'm just trying not to take that personally, that I need to get out there and compete, considering we're still sweating from going out there and playing today a match that ended up not being that
close.
The way
you were hitting it, you were probably sweating.
All right, I have editing capabilities on this end, so I can cut all that part out if need be.
When you are at home, what's a typical practice day look like usually?
It's usually involves some sort of practice, playing, and gym. You know, I'm pretty diligent with my trainer Keith McCormick here in Jacksonville, you know, it's definitely a good thing for me. It keeps my energy levels up and I just feel better. And then, you know, I'll work with my coach probably a couple times a week, twice a week usually when I'm home, and then yeah, just practice at either Sawgrass Country Club or TPC, and then try to play wherever I can, see if I can get a couple games going.
You seem like you are very in tune with kind of your thoughts. I don't know, you come across as a very smart guy, and having gone to Duke, it's apparent why. I'm just curious if you really go about setting goals for yourself, and you know, kind of what that, not necessarily if you don't want to go into like what those goals are, but do you set goals for yourself, you know, short, medium, long-term goals, or is it more, you know, hey, just put in the work and good things will happen?
No, I definitely do set goals. I mean, at the beginning of last year, you know, like you said, I was ranked at 1100 or whatever, but you know, I at the end of the year, I wanted to get to the top 100 in the world. And you know, I'd seen it done. I think Jordan Smith did it the year before, and Brooks did it a couple years back, and but they had done it after winning, I guess Jordan didn't, but you know, after winning multiple times out there and just playing really consistently. And that's, to me, that's the value, that's the sort of hallmark of really good, great players, is consistency. And that's where I wanted to be. So I was able to achieve that last year. This year I'd set higher goals, and you know, missing out on Augusta and the players was kind of a bummer for me. But there's still a lot, large part of the year left, and you know, I want to be consistent. You know, having one good week and then missing, you know, five cuts, or you know, just it doesn't. You know, I want to be in the mix every week. I just want to try to win every week, and that's. So I definitely have concrete goals that I'm kind of striving towards, and then all the other awards and, you know, all that stuff kind of takes care of itself.
Does consistency mean, you know, do you have certainly maybe a make cut comes to mind, but is there a certain place you want to finish, or is consistency more in kind of your approach and how you feel like you're actually playing?
It's more of a...
I know the two are very tied together,
sure,
of course, but...
But you can't have one without the other, I think. You know, I think, for example, a lot of it is a mentality thing, that I'm able to grind out a certain round when things aren't going my way. Like the Friday at the Open, when I was kind of back against the wall, and you kind of feel like things... There's like a sort of a tipping point. You kind of feel like things can go one way or the other at a certain point, and it's kind of your decision on how you're going to have your attitude be from there on out, and that can dictate a lot of how your result. And so and for me to be able to kind of buckle down there when it's my fifth week in a row, when you know, you could have whatever, things are going against me, things are going for me, a lot of that is just perspective. That's the sort of consistency I want to have every week, and that's, I think, what Tiger has every week and had, especially in his prime. And that's what I think all great competitors in any sport do. You look at Russell Westbrook, he goes out there every game, he tries to, you know, just gives everything he has. That's the kind of consistency. He's going to lose games, he's going to go 10 for 35, whatever, but he's going to keep giving it his all. That's the kind of sort of consistency I'm looking for. And you're going to miscut. You're going to, obviously, it's not always going to pan out. You're going to three putt. You're going to do these things. But as long as you're kind of mentally there for every part of it and you don't check out, that's all you can really ask for.
It seems like part of that is learning when those, you know, in the moment, when those moments come, I would imagine. So just being able to identify, hey, this is kind of a tipping point part of the round. I watch a lot of baseball. It kind of strikes me as the analogy. They say the really good pitchers, you know, they're never going to have their best stuff, but it's learning to compete and get results when you don't have your best stuff.
Yeah.
That's kind of what I was thinking about when you're going through that.
Yeah. 100%.
So much of golf, especially at your guys' level, is not about your good shots. It's about how bad your bad shots are. Or like if your average shot is really good, then you're going to score well. But if your average shot is just not, if your average shot is missing the green, like you, that's the cut line, I think,
yeah,
kind of in that world. Is there anything, I mean, obviously there's going to be a lot of things that you want to do better and whatnot, but is there anything specifically that stands out to you as, if I want to compete on the PGA Tour next year, I need to do this specific thing better? Is there one thing or anything that, have you thought that far ahead?
You know, I mean, there's things I want to improve on, you know, quite a bit. Just going forward in general, you know, I feel like my game is ready to compete at the PGA Tour, but I think to kind of go to that next level, you know, I practice a lot with Vijay Singh, when we're both back home in Jacksonville, and he's kind of giving me a lot of advice and, you know, on how to keep pushing forward with my game and my career and my ambitions. And I think, for me, I'd like to be a little bit more consistent putting. I think I could be much better. I think it's not really a mechanics thing. It's just more of a comfort thing. You know, it's going from grass to grass. It's a little bit different. But I think, you know, that's definitely something that because I feel like the rest of my game stacks up pretty well. And probably my wedges also coming in the greens, I could be a little bit more consistent.
Need some more those red balls.
red balls. Although I was throwing darts out there against you today, maybe you bring out the best in me.
Yeah, you were. You gave some. I think Mark, the another guy we played with today, said you gave a Ryder Cup stare at me after rolling in a long birdie on 17, which I like made six on that hole. You beat me by three on the hole. You didn't need to stare me down.
I'm like a great white. The smell of blood, you know, it just kind of keeps me.
Oh God. Got deep in my ass today. You just mentioned VJ. I was curious if there are any other veterans kind of that have mentored you either on the Euro Tour or in any guys that you kind of lean towards on that side.
Not really.
Who are some of your better friends on the European Tour?
Dylan Fratelli, who I mentioned before. Mm-hmm. We're in pretty much the exact same position now. We're playing the PGA and then doing the web finals, so we've got very similar world rankings. I've seen him at probably almost every event that I've played this year in the U.S. or in Europe. Eric Van Rooyen, he's another really nice guy, so another South African guy. Went to college in the States and has an American wife. And so we usually kind of hang out, have dinners, and spend quite a bit of time together.
Getting back to Vijay, I was watching last night the Fiji Championship, Fiji International. He was hitting cross-handed wedges from about 80, 90 yards. I was curious if you'd seen him working on that on the range at all.
I'd seen him that. Yeah, he's unbelievable. He's 55 years old, and the way he works at it and practices is unlike any. I've never seen a 25-year-old work like that. You see him hit the stuff. It's not like he's hitting it for the first time. He's worn out wedges, just hitting cross-handed pitches and chips. And I didn't realize he'd hit it 80, 90 yards. That's pretty far. But, I mean, he hits these things off downhill lies on grainy Bermuda over a bunker and nips them to, you know, inside of 4 feet. So it's the guy's, you know, he's incredible. And I have a lot of respect for – I feel like – a movie could be made or a book could be made very easily about his life. And I don't think he's probably opened up enough for that to happen. But
would he be a good podcast guest?
Maybe if he kicks your ass beforehand. I don't know. Like,
get him in a better mood.
Yeah.
All right. I'm going to end this with unless Randy has more questions after this, but this is admittedly a tough question and not something I've ever asked somebody on the pod, I don't think, before. But if you're to sketch it out now, goal-wise, what's a reasonable goal, a career comp, like a player that if you said if I'd have their career, I'd be very satisfied. Like when you're all said and done, if I had so and so's career, I'd be satisfied.
Man,
right?
I've never even thought about that. It's funny because I think, you know, I see Duke basketball players all the time, and you always compare them to like NBA players, like, oh, Brandon Ingram's like a Kevin Durant. Or, you know, people were saying Kyrie's going to be like a, I don't know, like a Jason Kidd, which, you know, Kyrie's filthy. But, you know, I think, wow, that's a tricky one. You know,
it's hard because you don't want to say like Phil and people think you're an idiot or you don't want to set the goal too low.
For wearing those shirts, right. Yeah. So I think, you know, although he looks like Neo in the Matrix now on that commercial, I think... you know, honestly, it's hard to compare, and I don't like to do that. I just want to get, you know, I think it was Kobe who said, you know, I just want to squeeze every, if my career is an orange, I just want to squeeze every bit of juice out of it that I can. And that's what I want to do. I want to put everything I have while I'm able to do it into it and just feel like I didn't leave anything behind. And whether that's, you know, ditching toxic relationships or, you know, just trying new things or, you know, like I said, finally working with an instructor, you know, that I feel like I can trust, just things like that. I think I don't want that stuff to kind of get in the way of what I'm trying to do.
That's a well-trained answer. That's much better than actually listing out a name. I wasn't trying to bait you, but I just think that's an interesting kind of question.
I got two rapid fire ones. Who's your favorite Duke basketball player?
Man, I'm freaking, I love watching Kyrie, and I know he played there for like 30 seconds, but he's my favorite player to watch in the NBA right now.
Okay. What's your favorite period of U.S. history?
this is going back into the memory banks. You know, I took a class on the 1960s. It was just the 1960s, and I thought it was fascinating. And, you know, I was genuinely interested. I mean, I wrote my final paper about Arnold Palmer and his influence on golf and TV and sports in general. And, you know, I didn't get a good grade on it because I think I went way off topic, but I think, or maybe I just can't write good.
Julian, well, the topic is the presidential election this year.
No, but it was just so much going on. I mean, you had JFK's assassination, you had Bobby Kennedy running for president, you had the Vietnam War going on, all the Pentagon Papers, the Nixon thing was kind of starting to come around. You had all the fight for women's equality, the racial tensions, MLK, the whole him getting assassinated. You had a lot of LGBT movements. I mean, there's just so much to cover. It was honestly, I mean, all those issues we only spent probably like 2 weeks on. You probably could have spent a class on any one of those issues. And I thought that was just so much going on. And I feel like, honestly, we're at a point in time now where a lot of those issues are resurfacing, and we could be kind of seeing history sort of repeat itself in the next few years.
Yeah. Well, last question, I promise. You have a lot of downtime traveling, I imagine, from here to Europe and back and whatnot. Are you a guy? Are you a Netflix guy? Do you like to read? How do you like to pass your time?
I try to read, but the read is like a who needs sleeping pills when you have some of these books. I enjoy some Netflix. I enjoy watching comedy stuff, funny stuff. I watch a lot of animated shows, animated movies, like Zootopia. I thought was hilarious. I've seen that like 4 times on planes. Rom-coms I like. Crazy Stupid Love I've seen like 15 times. Modern Family has me cracking up all the time. Curb Your Enthusiasm, yeah. I got into Game of Thrones for a little bit, but I just kind of lost interest. It's just, I don't know. I like to feel good when I watch something because, you know, golf can be a hard game to, you know, especially when watching someone's games like, you know, one of your games.
Oh my God.
You know, it's a little pick me up is always good. I enjoy watching the fun. Veep. Veep is one of the. I'm dying when I'm watching Veep. It's so funny.
Well, that's all.
Do you have a go-to Chappelle's? What's your favorite Chappelle skit of all time?
I got to gloss over one that I can't say, but I think, man, you know the.
It's hard to rank up there. I could. 8 different days, I might say 8 different skits.
Yeah, you know, I just watched on YouTube The Trading Spouses, and when I forgot
T
the
Mart.
Guy. Yeah, T-Mart. You know, when he's like, who the f- is with Renee Zellweger?
We watched the Mad Real when
Mad Real World,
the broadcast kept talking about all the guys staying in one house together at Carnoustie. We said, unless it's the Mad Real World recreated, we don't care about this house at all. And we watched that skit. Those things hold up just perfectly. There's nothing like other than clothing that's like a time period from those skits. It wasn't that long ago, but man, they still play really well today.
Yeah, I mean, I find myself, you know, I especially in the winter, you know, my elbows get ashy and I call myself Ashy Larry sometimes. I'm going to start a fire. I'm rich, bitch.
We're ending it on that. That's how they end the episodes. We're ending on that. So, Julian, thank you for the time, man. Thanks for kicking my ass, and we'll do it again soon.
And good luck next week in St. Louis.
Yeah, thanks, guys. Appreciate it. It was
fun.
Be the right club. Be the right club today.
Yes! Johnny, that's better than most.
How about him?
That is better than most. Better than most!
Expect anything different.